Atheists, for some reason, think that to defend their atheism, they have to debunk Jesus in some way or deny that he even existed. I find that fascinating. What is it? Because whether they want to acknowledge it or not, atheists recognize there is some kind of a Jesus connection to the God question. Mm-hmm. If you're going to talk about God, you can't help it. You got to talk about Jesus.
Welcome to Think About It, a podcast from Houston Baptist University here in Houston, Texas. At HBU, we empower our students so their beliefs can fuel their lives. From our competitive nursing program to our world-renowned theologians, we prepare our students to thrive at the university level and beyond. And now we join our host, Dr. Jerry Johnston, with today's guest.
Dr. Craig Evans is the John Bassanio Distinguished Professor of Christian Origins for Houston Baptist University. He's an expert on the historical grounds of New Testament writings. Dr. Evans has published more than 600 scholarly studies, including more than 70 books. And his book, Fabricating Jesus, How Modern Scholars Distort the Gospels, has been a bestseller, printed in several languages. Dr. Evans, you really are known as a Jesus scholar expert. Everywhere I go, I mean, everybody knows you all in the academic community. How many are there of you?
Well, it's hard to count that up. If you cast the net wide, there might be 100, maybe more than that. There'd be probably a couple dozen around the world, maybe three dozen, who would be considered frontline Jesus scholars who are active.
Now, I remember when the Pope Benedict had done a book and they asked a number of scholars to come to the Vatican. Three evangelical scholars were included and you were one of the three. Can you tell us about that experience?
That was really something. That was a few years ago. Benedict was still the Pope and he had published two books, actually, on the historical Jesus, and the second one, a big volume on Passion Week. And I was asked to review it. I was one of two Protestants asked to review it in a very unusual format. It was an open interview. It was like a massive teleconference call. There were 30 media reps. There were all kinds of people, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, all kinds of media. And I found myself getting most of the questions. I did a lot more talking than I thought I would be doing on that thing. And it wasn't long after that I got a call from the Vatican saying, you know, we're thinking about doing a conference focused on Christology, that is who Christ really was. And it's growing out of Pope Benedict's book. And we were interested in what you said in your review, and we want to know if you'd be willing to participate. And there were only two Protestants, actually, from North America. And I was one of the two. There were a couple of Protestants from Europe as well. Otherwise, it was dominated by Roman Catholics, as you might expect. And it took place, and of course, Pope Benedict retired, as we all know, and he was succeeded by Francisco I. And so it was in the first year of Pope Francis, or Francisco as he's called, as the new Pope. And we were invited to actually spend the week with the Pope where he lives in Vatican City. That just blew me away. Mm. It's the St. Martha Hotel, the Domus Sancta Martha. And I was on the second floor, and it was surreal. They were saying, now look, Professor Evans, you use the elevator B, and down the hallway, the Pope will use elevator A. So please don't use his elevator. I told him, okay, I won't. And don't go down the hall. That's where his room is over there. Just leave him alone. I said, oh, of course, no problem. And there I was in the cafeteria downstairs, sitting at a table, and right over there was the Pope, six mornings in a row, six breakfasts, two lunches, two dinners with the Pope. It was just an amazing situation. He'd look at me every time he walked in, he'd smile. I'd tip my head, smile back. He was gracious. I had a chance to shake his hand, talk to him very briefly when the conference was over. But it was an electrifying experience. And it was a There were 500 people there listening to it too. So it was attended by the public, and there were about 20, 21, 22 scholars that presented. My paper was included in the two-volume work that came out that was published only months later.
And how was his book on?
You know, I thought Pope Benedict the 16th was truly a great scholar. He was a theologian, he was an exegete, and he had the warmth, pastoral warmth.
Was he a German, eh?
And he's German. He's Joseph Ratzinger.
Mm-hmm.
And he was Pope John Paul II's right-hand man when it came to doctrine, theology, and academics. And I don't know if there's anybody his equal. And so Ratzinger was amazing. And I thought he was a very good pope. And I was disappointed I didn't get the chance to see him. He was not well when we were there. But at least I did get to see Pope Francis.
Mm-hmm.
And what an experience. It was just amazing.
Now talk to me for a minute about the uniqueness of Jesus Christ. We live in this pluralistic society, and we've traveled around the globe, both of us, and a lot of deities that are worshipped, a lot of different philosophies and isms. Do you exclusively look at Jesus Christ as unique and superior?
Oh, I certainly do. You raise an important question. Naturally, Christians are going to respond and say Jesus is unique. He's special. He's unequaled. But what I find interesting, because I have studied other religious traditions, also I know Islam very well, Judaism, and other faiths, and Jesus is the person everybody wants his endorsement. I find that fascinating. People who aren't particularly religious, people who aren't Christians, people who might be Muslims, they might be Buddhists, they might be something else. It is interesting how people, it's like they want to know what Jesus thinks about this or that. It's like it's inside the hearts of people. They want his endorsement. That's the way I put it. That's unparalleled. The only people that care about Muhammad are Muslims. The only people who care about Buddha are Buddhists. But there's something about Jesus. It's like theism. You know, I don't care what the atheists want to tell you. Committed atheists represent not even 5% of the world's population.
Mm-hmm.
The theism is the overwhelming majority, and it always has been. As long as we have human beings, they're theists. And then right next to it, Jesus is there for some reason. Even though people might not, you know, be Christians, they know about Jesus, they want his blessing, they want his endorsement in one way or the other. I find that fascinating. That's unprecedented, it's unequaled. So is Jesus unique? You bet he is. And besides, Buddha wasn't resurrected. Muhammad didn't die for his people. He wasn't raised up. This is unique. So who Jesus is, what he accomplished, the impact he's had on the world is unrivaled. It is unique. And there's another thing I'll say about that. I find it fascinating. It's only atheists who do this. Atheists, for some reason, think that to defend their atheism, they have to debunk Jesus in some way or deny that he even existed. I find that fascinating. What is it? Because whether they want to acknowledge it or not, atheists recognize there is some kind of a Jesus connection to the God question.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to talk about God, you can't help it. You got to talk about Jesus. And that's unique. It doesn't ever, who says you need to make an argument that Muhammad didn't exist? Who cares? Who tries to mount an argument that maybe there was no Buddha? It's just all a myth. Nobody bothers. Jesus seems to be the key, and he's always the focus. I think that shows that he is indeed unique.
Now, I remember when you were prepping me for David Fitzgerald, the mythicist, you know, self-appointed mythicist. I mean, the mythicist argument has been pretty patently debunked, has it not?
Well, from an academic point of view, yes, of course. But there are some odd birds out there. Richard Carrier, Peter Freak, and a couple of others, for some reason they're out there and oh, they think they've got some new evidence that Jesus didn't exist. But mainstream academics, whether they're atheists or whatever they are, Jewish scholars, they laugh at that. But whether they're mainstream scholars or whoever they are, they know that that's just silly. But for some reason, out and about in the popular circles, there's this fad. And that's, it's like Bigfoot. It's like ufology, right. UFOs. There's this idea that, hey, you know what, there's some kind of conspiracy out there. Maybe there never was a Jesus. But it's really silly. And the major league scholars, whatever theological stripe they may have, historians, major league scholars, there's no doubt that Jesus existed. If we are so skeptical about our past, about our records, about the archaeology, about our past, our ability to remember the past, our ability to write history, if we're that skeptical, then we don't know anything prior to the age of recording audio and visual.
The person of Jesus Christ is a lightning rod in a certain sense. When you go to the academic world, you go to the global world. I mean, we don't say, oh, Muhammad. We use the explanative of Jesus Christ. And Jesus spoke about the offense of the cross. And he said, I believe in John 7:7, the world cannot hate you, but me it hateth. Why is he so divisive?
Well, I think that goes right to the point I was making earlier. Jesus is linked to God. And I think people instinctively, I think it's because every human being, no matter how wicked or foolish, every human being is made in the image of God. And so there's this spirituality, there's this godness connection in every human. And so Jesus is part of that. Muhammad isn't, and Buddha's not. You know, Confucius isn't. Other religious teachers and so on, they're not. But Jesus is. And so when you curse, you use a divine name. When you curse, you invoke the name of the Lord, and that includes Jesus. It's interesting. But as you said, not Muhammad. Why is that? It's because Jesus is connected to the deity. He's connected to divinity. And I think the human being reacts to that. Even the atheist reacts to that, which is why I was saying a minute ago, they want to say, if they're going to say there's no God, they will sometimes, as ludicrous as it is, they'll go ahead and then try to make an argument that, well, maybe there wasn't a Jesus either. It's really interesting to see that connection.
Now, we both have been to Galilee, that area north of Jerusalem. Even today, it's so obscure. I can't even imagine what it was like in Jesus' day. Capernaum. I mean, we've all been to Peter's house. And you know, when we look at the geography of Jesus' ministry, what is it, 150 miles at the most?
Yeah, that's right. It's a very small territory.
Yeah, and the Jesus trail or path, I remember we passed the other day, a lot of people. How could someone so obscure, born in what was a postage stamp village at the time, have such repercussions over the centuries of humanity, such as Jesus Christ?
I think there's only one answer for that, and that is he in fact was who he said he was. His disciples correctly perceived who he really was. And because if Jesus ultimately had been nothing more than some teacher with some interesting ideas about the kingdom of God, if he had been nothing more than an ethical person who says, you know, you ought to love your neighbors yourself, or you ought to do this or that, if that's all he was. And there were plenty of rabbis who taught those kinds of things. Jesus was not the only teacher that told parables and had some interesting sayings and so forth. If that's all he was, then we wouldn't be sitting here, we wouldn't be talking about this. He would have left nobody'd know who he is. It wouldn't be remembered. There are plenty of people that claim to be prophets and got killed in the world of Jesus at that approximate time, and nothing remains. There's no movement, nothing started. But I think the reason that Jesus could have been born in a big city or a tiny village, it doesn't matter. He is who he said he was. His disciples perceived that. And his death on the cross accomplished his saving work. The resurrection verified the truth of it and energized his following. And that's why we're sitting here. That's why the world has been changed. That's why almost a third of the world acknowledges him to one degree or another as Lord and Savior. It's because he really was who he said he was. It's because his following recognized that he was the Messiah, that he really was God's son, that he was the game changer. His death on the cross and then his resurrection altered the world permanently.
And as we both know, 36 months is such a brief time. I mean, you barely get to know your wife in the first 3 years of marriage, let alone anybody else. And yet he had a ministry of 3 years and left such an imprint on history. How could that be?
Well, you know, he's divine. There's a supernatural power at work. You know, I'm not sure how much would have been different if his ministry had been for 25 years instead of 2 or 3 years. I think in that period of time, I mean, we have the New Testament, we have the four Gospels. It's a finite set of material. It doesn't take very long to read the Gospels. Most scholars think that we have probably 90% of what he actually taught. So not 90% of everything he ever said, but 90% of what he taught, what he wanted his disciples to learn and teach others. And what's there is hugely powerful. I mean, you know, an atom bomb is a small bomb, but boy, look what it does when it goes off. Mm-hmm. So here you've got this nuclear teaching that just explodes and alters the world. So I don't think Jesus's ministry had to be any longer than it was. I don't think the actual corpus body of his teaching needed to be any bigger than it is. I think, you know, the truth and valuable things come in small packages. And so you've got enough. It's deep and it's effective. And it is what it has to be, and look what it's done. I think the results speak for themselves.
We're talking to Dr. Craig Evans, one of the foremost Jesus scholars of the world, who we have the privilege to have at Houston Baptist University as the John Bisogno Distinguished Professor of Christian Origins, and who also teaches in our seminary at Second Baptist Church, the Houston Theological Seminary, the Seminary of Houston Baptist University. Dr. Evans, I want to just take this a little bit further, because I've seen you in the boxing ring with Bart Ehrman and people like him, and I don't want to give Ehrman a lot of play, but yesterday I was on the phone with Lacona down in Atlanta, and we were talking as well about the whole debate thing. But, you know, Ehrman has this spiritual experience. We're talking about the religion chair at UNC, who is effectively a deconversion. And then he becomes so critical of the Gospels. And he tries with all of his heart to dismantle the faith. And we know the media, the press is skewed left. They give Ehrman all kinds of play, all kinds of review. And equally intellectually challenging books, they give them very, very few. What is Ehrman's real argument, and what is your real rebuttal in Synoptis?
I think it falls into 2 points. One of them is biblical, historical, relates to the Gospels, and the other one is theological and personal and emotional. Those are the 2 points. I knew Bart Ehrman back in the days when he was had just finished his doctorate at Princeton. I was at Princeton in 1987, 88.
Not a deconversion at the time.
No, and he would have considered himself sort of a moderate, not a very conservative, but sort of a moderate, almost liberal Christian at that time. And it wouldn't be until 2000 or so, the year 2000, 2001, that he just completely walked away from faith. But the issue with him, and he has said this in debates, he has hinted at it in his books, that it's the suffering in the world. And since I know him personally and know people who know him very well, I think you really should interpret that as the suffering and emotional disappointments in his own life is what it really is. And this gets projected out as some sort of a generalization about suffering around the world. But there were some tragedies in his own life. And he couldn't square this theologically with what he had learned when he was a young fundamentalist. And I would say the same thing is true at the other point on Bible. Mm-hmm. He had a fundamentalist understanding of Scripture. And
there are no errors whatsoever in the translations of the New Testament.
That's right.
And we use this word inerrancy in a very powerful way without understanding
I think so.
Textual variants, et cetera.
I think it actually runs deeper than that. I think the problem is, and this is the area of my expertise, and that is the historical Jesus, what the Gospels are, how they were written, in what sense their history, how Jesus taught his disciples, how he taught them his own teaching, and what he wanted them to do with it. That's not what these guys understand, whether it's Bart Ehrman or these other brittle fundamentalists who are either still believers or no longer are believers. And they've got a bad understanding, an inaccurate understanding of what the Gospels are. So it's not just mistakes. They can't deal with what to them are discrepancies. Well, wait a minute, Matthew puts it this way, but Luke puts it this other way. And I've heard Bart Ehrman say that. I'll say, well, they can't both be true. Well, actually, they can be. And the reason he gets into this dilemma is he's interpreting these ancient writings through a modern fundamentalist lens. And that's why he is criticized by some people.
Hang on one second. Interpreting these ancient writings in a modern
fundamentalist lens.
And so put that down in layman's language.
Well, what that means is, like, you know, when I ask a student to write a paper and they quote somebody, I want them to quote that person word for word and put it in quotation marks. Give me a footnote. Tell me which page, you know, and so on. That's not the way it was in antiquity, and that's not the way Jesus taught his own disciples. He told them that if you're a scribe trained for the kingdom of heaven,
right,
then you know how to open up the thesaurus, the treasure box, and pull out the old stuff and the new stuff. What he is telling his disciples, if you understand my teaching, you can apply it. And what we know from the school books, the handbooks from 2,000 years ago, that meant paraphrasing. So you're the great teacher, I learn your teaching, I paraphrase it, I reword it to fit different contexts, different languages, different settings, so that the people hearing it understand your teaching.
An oral rabbinic
A little bit, yeah. It isn't just the oral part, it isn't just the rabbinic part, that is simply how they taught.
Yeah.
We are word for word exact,
gotcha.
Quotation marks. Where was he when he said it? What time of day was it? When was it? And if you have two versions that answer those questions somewhat differently, we say that's a discrepancy. That's the modern perspective. That's foreign to 2,000 years ago. And so these Gospels tell the Jesus story very effectively, dramatically, effectively, very, very well. And they are true to what Jesus himself taught. They are true to how he told his disciples to teach. Take his teaching, adapt it, apply it so people understand it.
So they were not necessarily stenographers.
No, they're not parrots.
Right.
Repeating verbatim.
And there wasn't a dictaphone.
No. And there wouldn't. There shouldn't be.
Right.
There didn't need to be. They could memorize. The memorization is not a problem. Anybody can memorize. The scribe, that's why he says it's in Matthew 13, verse 52. Have you understood my teaching? He asked the disciples. They say, yes, good, because every scribe, every scholar, every one of my graduates trained, and the word trained is the same word as discipled.
Yeah.
So every scribe who's been discipled properly knows how to go into that treasure box that I've gifted you and pull out new stuff, old stuff, and apply it and teach other people. So Jesus is the originator of the discrepancies, if you will, because he does the same thing in his ministry. He repeats his parables, but with variations as he goes from village to village. Now his disciples do the same thing. So when we sit down with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and we compare them, we see the discrepancies. We better see them. If there weren't anything there, there'd be something wrong. And what we're seeing that we call discrepancies, alterations in wording and so on, this is the disciples doing pedagogically what Jesus taught them to do. And they're taking his teaching and applying it in new ways in different settings.
So would it be correct saying that Mark got most of his gospel from Peter, that Luke, being a Greek doctor, an analytical man, probably reviewed Matthew?
Well, I think most scholars, it's not everybody, but most scholars say Mark is first and does have that Petrine connection. Luke is saying, okay, Mark, that's great, but I want Jesus's teaching to speak to a different setting here. Matthew comes along, does the same thing. Mark, this is great. I'm going to take this stuff, but I'm going to edit it and supplement it and make it speak to a skeptical synagogue. Luke is speaking mostly to Gentiles who say, how does this Jewish Messiah have any relevance for me? Well, let me show you. And so they're doing what Jesus taught his disciples to do. I think Jesus, if he were to sit down at this table and say, let me read Matthew, Mark, Luke, he'd give them A's. He'd say, good job. Guys, good job. Mm-hmm. You did what I asked you to do. But a fundamentalist modern comes along, a fundamentalist who might be a skeptic, not just a believer, and does not understand this, reads these gospels the way we think history should be recorded.
Right.
And they go, oh, I don't understand that. The wording is a little bit different. What's going on here? Somebody made a mistake. That's the real problem with Bart Ehrman. That's why I don't have any difficulty debating him. I get out in front of this train wreck and I explain that to the audience.
And can you, in layman's language, just explain textual variants in the ancient manuscripts?
Sure. Well, the word manuscript means it's written by hand, so it's not replicated on a printing press. And so every time somebody sits down with a pen and writes out, and we're talking about thousands of lines, every time they write out a whole gospel or the entire New Testament, invariably they'll make mistakes. They'll zone out. They'll actually print twice the same line. They'll leave a line
sure.
out. They make mistakes like that. And somebody will come along and correct it. Well, what we talk about variance is we'll say this manuscript reads the same as everybody else, except this word is different. That's a variant. That's
right.
What we mean by it. So then we ask ourselves, how do you account for that? And so there are thousands of variants. And Bart Ehrman has made a big deal out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there are more variants and scribal mistakes, and there are actually words in the New Testament, something like that. Well, that's, of course, meaningless. We have thousands of manuscripts, and you're going to have variants in all of them. And so you end up with this large number, but it's meaningless. When you take these manuscripts and compare them, you can quickly smoke out the mistakes. You quickly get back to the text, 99.9% the original text. So that really is not a big issue. That is a red herring. He was playing off of that with his misquoting Jesus.
And played off of it to the stupidity of the American public, selling
of course.
Hundreds of thousands
oh,
of
yes,
books.
Oh, yes, yes. The public is naive, and the left-wing media, you touched on that a few minutes ago, they love that, they lap it up, they lionize it, they give Bart a lot of chance to talk about that.
Yeah. Well, we see the importance of a solid theology from a professor and a scholar like Dr. Craig Evans. And that's precisely what is offered at HBU School of Christian Thought. You need to check it out. You can do it online. You can be an auditor at the seminary at Second Baptist Houston, 6400 Woodway. Tell us what an auditor is.
Yeah, we call them surveyors, and it's very popular. There are a lot of people who are lay people, of course, at Second Baptist and other churches. They're not ready to enroll in a degree program, but they would like to hear the courses. They're invited in. And we had 335 of these surveyors last year.
And so they're invited. Anybody
yeah.
can come.
Yeah.
And you do that teaching on what night?
I teach Tuesday nights at Second Baptist at the Woodway campus. And it's really great. I'll have my 13, 14, 15 MDiv students taking it for credit, sitting in the front row on tables. But then there are these backbenchers, 100 surveyors taking notes and getting in on it too. This enriches the church. Many of them teach Sunday school classes. Some of them are on staff.
Absolutely.
And there they are soaking up the class.
I don't know why everybody wouldn't do it. That's the Houston Theological Seminary of Houston Baptist University. And Dr. Craig Evans, the distinguished professor, John Bisogno of Christian Origins at HBU. Go to hbu.edu/Christian Thought to learn more about the School of Christian Thought, to enroll residentially or online, Or you can call the admissions number and just ask all the questions you want, 281-649-3211. Dr. Evans, thank you so much for being here, and I got an idea we're going to be revisiting in the days ahead.
At HBU, we influence the culture around us by challenging our students to put their beliefs into action every day.